But when you got a guy like Stefan Ramsdorf, who spent 35 years studying the AMOC, and when he says that he's very worried of it shutting off in 2 or 3 decades, and then the study comes out greatly narrowing the probability of it shutting down. Instead of being a third, it's up to a half. The uncertainty's greatly reduced on that half number. I'm not sure. I mean, science is going to keep studying this and it'll keep looking at it until the darn thing actually shuts off.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Climate Emergency Forum. I'm Herb Simmons, author of A Climate Vocabulary of the Future, and I will be your host today. We've had some programs and some very disturbing news recently about climate. The World Meteorological Organization report on the Earth energy imbalance getting worse and other calamities, the possibility of a super El Nino. And it would be nice if we could shift to something more positive, but the news is still bad. And so today we're going to focus on yet another potentially devastating dimension of the climate crisis, and that is the potential collapse of what is called the AMOC, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, which is a worldwide circulation that primarily affects the climate in the North Atlantic, but really throughout the planet. And the fact that a number of studies are showing danger signs with respect to whether this circulation will continue to provide the moderate climate benefits that Europe and other places experience. So it's an important conversation. We're glad that you're here today. And I want to urge you to subscribe to our channel, to like our channel, to go to our website, climateemergencyforum.org, to donate if you can, to leave your questions and your comments. And as always, at the very end of the program, I will be talking about three of the biggest climate stories of the past week, what we call the Climate Three. We have with us our regular panelists, Dr. Peter Carter from British Columbia. Peter, you've started the Climate Emergency Institute. You're a retired medical doctor, and we have Paul Beckwith from Ottawa, Canada. Paul, you're a climate system scientist and host of an extremely popular and important YouTube channel. So with that, there's nothing more I want to say. We have lots of really important information and conversation from Peter and Paul on the AMOC. So let's start with Peter. Welcome, Peter.
As long as I can remember, the scientists have been totally agreed on the fact that the AMOC on the continued global warming would slow and eventually it would collapse, and that would have a catastrophic cooling, cold, freezing effect on Scandinavia and particularly on Europe and put Europe's agricultural production at high risk. I'm going to mention very quickly a paper that's just been published, co-author Stefan Ramsdorf, who we like a lot because he's very good on the AMOC. And this paper states this: the stability of the AMOC system is determined primarily by fresh water flux, secondarily by temperature. So this fresh water flux is the situation that Wally Brocker anticipated and published many years ago: massive amounts of fresh water coming from the Arctic and off the melting surface of Greenland glaciers, etc. So in this paper, quote, it states the stability of the AMOC system is determined primarily by this fresh water flux, secondarily by temperature. So that brings me to Wally Brocker. If James Hansen is the father of climate change, Wallace Brocker is the grandfather. Came to my attention that he published a paper in 1975 that accurately projected the global warming of 2020, completely accurate. So I found this paper that he published in 1997 entitled, "Will Our Ride into the Greenhouse Be a Smooth One?" He suggested, no, it won't, that the past 8 to 10,000 years have been unusually smooth, stable climate for our agriculture. But before that, the climate was characterized by frequent, extremely abrupt global shifts. And one of those shifts is the ocean's thermohaline circulation, of which the AMOC is the northern aspect. It was actually called the conveyor belt, and it was termed a Brocker's conveyor belt because he was the first person who published all this. And what he published was that the thermohaline AMOC would event slow and collapse, and it would produce this dramatic scenario that I've just described. He also published another paper in the same year called Thermohaline Circulation: The Achilles Heel of the Climate System. In 2001, a contemporary, highly respected climate expert, Thomas Stocker, published a paper called The Future of the Thermohaline Circulation, in which he said that this circulation was driven by differences in heat and fresh water fluxes at the surface of the North Atlantic. So there we are again with this massive fresh water flux volume. The next paper I found was another highly respected expert, Richard Alley. In 2007, Alley published a paper. He's one of the big ice core experts. And the title of the paper was Wally Was Right: The Predictive Ability of the North Atlantic Conveyor Belt Hypothesis for Abrupt Change Is Right. And he stated in this paper that this had happened before and it was due to changing fresh water fluxes. So today, just to finish this off, I've looked at Copernicus, and the climate disruption is way extreme than I've ever seen. The entire surface of Greenland is the anomaly temperature has heated up more than any other part of the Earth, the entire surface of Greenland. And there is a vast amount of cold water below Greenland, quite a bit, encompassing much of the North Atlantic. So we're talking about this cold region, which is up to 50,000 square miles.
Thanks, Peter. I really appreciate the important history and including some of the famous scientists whose work influences and helps define the situation we're now in with the AMOC. Let me turn to Paul now, who I believe will talk more to sort of pick up where you left off, Peter, in terms of talking about some of the science of the AMOC and what it might mean for us. Paul?
Yes, thanks, Herb, and thank you, Peter. So, just a few years ago, in the peer-reviewed scientific research, they argued that the probability of the AMOC shutting down, or re the reduction of the AMOC by 2100, would be 32% plus or minus 37%. So that's a huge error range, and it's about a third, one in three chance. And they said that with 90% certainty. So the most recent paper, just published within the last few weeks, is arguing that the probability of the AMOC severely reducing, shutting down essentially by 2100, is now between 43% and 59%. They said it was 51% plus or minus 8%. So they've really tightened up the uncertainty. In articles about that paper, Stefan Ramsdorf is quoted. Now, he's with the Potsdam Institute for Climate in Germany, probably, world-renowned institute and top-notch research on the AMOC. Stefan has been researching the AMOC for 35 years. He's quoted as saying, "I am increasingly worried that we may well pass that AMOC tipping point where it becomes inevitable in the middle of this century, which is to shut down," which is quite close. I mean, we're talking about 2050, which is only 2.5 decades, 2 to 3 decades away. We have lots of data in measuring the AMOC and the ocean currents at various depths and various latitudes. So there's on the western boundary current, where the AMOC runs up northward off the east coast of North America, right, the western part of the ocean basin. At 16.5 degrees north, we have something called the MOVE Array. 26.5 degrees north is the most quoted data. It's called the RAPID Array. And then we have the Woods Hole has an array at 39.5 degrees north latitude. And then we have the RAPID Scotia Canadian Woods Hole collaboration, and it's at 42.5 degrees north. So we've got lots of data on the AMOC. We think the AMOC is the weakest it's been in 1600 years. And there's a lot of internal variability in the AMOC, which is not a good thing because if that internal variability results in you crossing a threshold or tipping point, the whole thing can collapse, shut down. So if it does shut down, say 2050, what are the consequences to humanity? And we can't understate them. I call the AMOC the mother of all tipping points. So we would expect with an AMOC shutdown, we'd get a reconfiguration of the ocean currents that would reconfigure the atmospheric jet streams, and everything on the planet would change. It would be like we were suddenly on a new planet. CO2 rise would be very quickly in the atmosphere, would be between 47 and 83 parts per million increase. The Arctic would experience 7 degrees cooling between 60 degrees and 90 degrees latitude north. The Antarctic would experience a 6 degrees Celsius warming between 60 degrees and 90 degrees south. Like I said, we'd be on a totally different planet because there'd be a change in ocean currents, change in the intertropical convergence zone. So, what's going on with the rain belts in the tropics? The jet streams would completely change. Temperature, humidity, extreme weather would change where it strikes and when. And we wouldn't be able to grow much food anymore, unfortunately, because all of the ideal growing conditions for global crops would no longer be valid. It could take a century to reestablish crops because you need to build up soils. So we would have definitely global food shortages and massive loss of human numbers. And, are there signs that we're getting closer? Peter mentioned the global warming hole south of Greenland, cool spot. We set a record minimum of Arctic sea ice in 2012. It looked like it was going to go to a blue ocean event, less than 1 million square kilometers. That never happened. And, so is it possible that the Arctic's already cooling a bit? And I just want to finish up by saying Antarctic sea ice grew about 1.5% per decade for many, many decades up to 2015. In 2015, sea ice around Antarctica dropped off a cliff. It looks like there is a complete state change in sea ice in Antarctica. This would be, indicative of warming in Antarctica. So I would say there's a lot of signs that we're already pushing towards that threshold. So it's a very, very risky situation for humanity.
Thanks, Paul. Both of your comments cannot be described as anything other than grim, if not alarming. But that also means that we hope that world leaders will pay attention and act. What's your sense of how important and how effective aggressive emission reductions can be in slowing or stopping any collapse of the AMOC?
Well, I found a recent paper, December 2025. It actually answers this. It's again a very complicated paper. It's called Noise-Induced Tipping of the AMOC under Climate Mitigation. So what they did was, again, they modeled and they sought to find out what would happen if atmospheric CO2 concentration magically stopped increasing. And what they found was that the effect depends on the stage of the AMOC slowing. So, if the AMOC slowing had reached beyond a certain threshold, it was very hard to predict that the mitigation would have a beneficial effect. But they made it very clear, and this didn't come across on the reporting, that implementing stronger mitigation actions, such as carbon neutrality or negative emissions, could allow AMOC recovery, even if it temporarily crosses the tipping point. While such aggressive mitigation efforts may come with high economic cost, they could ultimately prevent far greater socioeconomic and climatic consequences. So that's the answer. We have to mitigate, we have to reduce CO2 emissions and other emissions very, very fast to get ahead of the slowing and the tipping point of the AMOC.
Okay, Paul, what's your perspective on what's the, are we too late for emission reductions, even if we can do them more aggressively, which there are no signs that we are or will? But if that happens, can that theoretically at least slow or stop the collapse of the AMOC?
Well, if we do, the goal is to zero emissions, but we'll still be at the very high levels of CO2 and other greenhouse gases that we're at. So the system will still continue to change and we'll go through this AMOC shift.
Okay, so what I'm hearing, I think, from both Peter and Paul is that as much as emission reductions are essential, that we can't count on them in any way, shape, or form to significantly delay or stop any AMOC collapse. With that, let me go to our second round and turn it back to Peter. Peter, any additional thoughts you have?
The AMOC is one of these abrupt climate changes, which has a dramatic tipping point. And unfortunately, and very oddly, none of these are included in the IPCC's projection of global temperature increase and projection of impacts. So the massive effect on the climate of AMOC is not included. Basically, they say we don't know what's going to happen. But even more importantly, thawing permafrost, which is emitting all three greenhouse gases, CO2, methane, and nitrous oxide today, that's not included in the projections. Warming peatlands, and the peatlands are almost as much carbon as the permafrost, and they are also emitting methane and also nitrous oxide, so that's not included. Also, the collapse of the Amazon rainforest, which is very, very close. The Amazon rainforest is now not acting as an affecting carbon sink for us. That's not included as a change in global climate and global warming. Nor is the loss of the African rainforest. There's been two recent papers published on that. The loss of these carbon sinks will have a massive effect, driving up, accelerating global warming even faster. And the other thing, which to me was absolute terrible news, was the finding that the vast boreal subpolar Arctic forest was beginning to weaken as a carbon sink because it was projected that under global warming, the boreal forest would dry, and that would be highly detrimental to its functioning.
Okay, Paul, any additional thoughts you have?
For many years, I've been saying that slashing fossil fuel emissions is not enough. It's only a third of what we need to do. Another third is to draw CO2 and methane out of the atmosphere to try to restore a some sort of semblance of healthy planet. And then we need to cool the planet actively in order to prevent these tipping points from occurring. So I think it's pretty, I think I've been pretty clear over the years, over many years, that that's, I think, what's required. So we're just getting closer and closer to very bad things happening. And I do want to add that if the AMOC does shut off, it can be off anywhere from centuries to a millennia, 1,000 years. We know this from the shutoffs during the coming out of the last ice age, the so-called Dansgaard-Oscher oscillations followed by Heinrich events. So we've seen this many times, this behavior on the Earth system many times in the past, and this is how we feel quite confident that we're going to see it again, given our present course, the present course that humanity is taking.
Paul, how much evidence is there right now that, in fact, solar radiation management, I call it direct climate cooling, can, in fact, if started presumably quickly enough and effectively enough, slow or stop AMAC? Or is it largely just a kind of theoretical possibility at this point?
I think we know with 100% certainty that the Earth will cool. It happens when there's a large volcano going off, and it can cool a half to a 1/2 degree Celsius to 1 degree Celsius, and it can stay cool for 3 to 5 years. We understand the mechanisms at which CO2 is removed from the ocean. About a quarter of human emissions are removed by the ocean each year. So if we can slightly enhance that removal, and I think we can, I think there's some very good, clever methods to do such, then we can very quickly draw down CO2 from the atmosphere, not talking about zeroing emissions. What I think is the most likely scenario is that we find that we can do these methods of drawing down CO2, and we have to draw down enough to compensate for all the emissions that happen on a yearly basis, but be far above that by about two-thirds to withdraw the levels and drop them from 430 parts per million down to levels where humans have existed. Our whole existence has been at levels under about 300 parts per million. So that, it's good news and bad news. It's just, it's in our hands. It's in humanity's hands. We've done this to our planet and we have the means to get out of it. But how do you spread this message to people? How do you spread it to Western governments who don't want to even reduce emissions? And I've mentioned previously that I would say if you can convince some Chinese engineers, they have the means and the money and the technology, they can just go and start doing it. And then the rest of the world can say, hey, how come CO2 levels are dropping? So I'm very optimistic about that sort of angle, whether other people are or not. That's my stand on this. So yes, I think the AMOC is shifting is not a sure thing, but certainly the way we're heading, it's a sure thing. Like if you're heading somewhere at top speed and you don't put the brakes on, you're going to eventually reach where you're heading. I think we can, but whether we will is a whole other question.
We have many viewers from Northern Europe. If you were advising the viewers from the countries that are likely, as I understand it, to be hit hardest by a dramatic cold wave over some period of time, yet unknown, and starting at some period of time, yet unknown, what would you have our viewers ask their governments to do right now in terms of adapting to the possibility of AMOC? Because there's certainly no assurance that humanity, given our track record, will act in time either with emission reductions and or carbon removal and or direct cooling to be able to prevent an AMAC shutdown, which of course, as we want to emphasize, is by no means certain that next year a study may come out, and as happened over the last couple of years in following these studies, every year a study comes out saying it's more likely, it's less likely, it's more likely. But given that reality, given extremely deep uncertainty that governments and citizens have to act in, what might you advise our viewers to ask their governments to do?
What the Europeans should demand is the immediate termination of fossil fuel subsidies. All the countries are subsidizing the fossil fuel industry. And the fact is, and all the scientists are completely agreed on this, we cannot stabilize the climate, we cannot stabilize the oceans without getting off fossil fuel energy and stopping that vast amount of CO2 emissions, which is coming from the fossil fuel industry. Also, we have a large amount of methane emissions. We have other emissions from the fossil fuel industry that complicates everything even further. So that's what we have to propose. But we also have to have emergency removal of CO2. And I've been saying this for many, many years, and there is really no emergency action. We need a massive project, massive funding, massive resources, so that we can rapidly remove CO2 from the air. We cannot do that at the moment. We have no capacity. The other thing that we have to do, because we've been talking about the AMOC, we've been talking about North Atlantic, Arctic, Greenland, is we have to cool the Arctic. Many of us have been saying this for many, many years as well. We have to stabilize the permafrost. We have to stabilize the Greenland melt. We have to attempt to stabilize the AMOC. And this may well have a chance of stabilizing the AMOC. So we have to institute all of those interventions. It'll take a huge amount of funding and resources.
Paul?
I think the purpose of science is to try to understand how things operate and connect, and there's always going to be some uncertainty. But when you got a guy like Stefan Ramsdorf, who spent 35 years studying the AMOC, and when he says that he's very worried of it shutting off in 2 or 3 decades, and then the study comes out greatly narrowing the probability of it shutting down. Instead of being a third, it's up to a half. The uncertainty's greatly reduced on that half number. I'm not sure. I mean, science is going to keep studying this and it'll keep looking at it until the darn thing actually shuts off. So, what politicians and our world literally is screwed up because most of Western countries are being run by people who have no understanding of science and engineering. And how do you convince somebody who doesn't understand basic science and engineering, who's running a country, to do things that are scientifically important for the country to do. It's very, very difficult to do. So this is the predicament that we're in. This is the situation we're in. How can I go and say, we've got to slash fossil fuels, we need to do this, when for 4 decades, people have been screaming, well, it's Earth Day today, right? The first Earth Day was 1970. We've got to get off fossil fuels, we've got to do this. You can't keep saying this for 4 decades and actually believe it yourself when you say it. So I just don't believe it. I don't see, I mean, our emissions are higher than they've ever been in history. So 4 decades of environmentalists and people saying we have to slash emissions, and then they're at record high levels. I mean, there's just no credibility in saying that anymore. So this is why we have no choice but to figure out these technologies to draw down CO2 and methane from the atmosphere and to cool the planet while we're drawing it down. Now, if we can draw it down in a couple of decades, then great. We don't need to necessarily cool the planet. And until a few weeks ago, I thought that that would be the case. We may have to absolutely cool the planet with the aerosol, stratospheric aerosol injection. But now I'm not so sure because I think there are some very promising techniques to draw it down very quickly, a very large scale. If people just started doing it and then other people got on board, it's like a positive tipping point. I mean, Lenten wrote a great book. New book that's just come out on positive tipping points. And he talks a lot about solar and wind and batteries, electric cars. And also, Bill McGibbon just has a new book on how we can do everything with the sun. And I love his quote saying that the sun comes millions of miles to Earth and it doesn't actually pass through the Strait of Hormuz.
Yes, one doesn't need to have a degree in geography to recognize the wisdom and the cleverness of what Bill just said. What I'm hearing really is, I'm not sure how to summarize what the two of you said, except to say that we have a real dilemma. But at this point, at least according to the experts, it's kind of a coin flip. It's by no means certain that the AMAC will collapse significantly this century. And it's important. What I would say, if I were answering my own question, is the first thing I would do is to recommend to world leaders that they establish a very high-level international commission of politicians, economists, philosophers, a whole range of an ordinary people to examine the evidence and to listen to the top scientists like Stefan and others, and to issue a call for action, whatever that call for action may consist of. And that is totally non-existent in the world. To me, that's completely absurd. The only thing we have these individual papers that usually get a couple days publicity at best, that are published in obscure journals. And then we have the COPs that we have all attended that accomplish usually nothing. We have the IPCC that meets every 6 years. In 6 years, the planet could be gone given the way things are. So we need a new institutional structure. And I just want to indicate that coming up, our next program I want to really encourage people to watch is with an incredibly experienced gentleman by the name of Janos Pastor, who worked at the highest levels of international climate diplomacy for many decades. And I think it's in that conversation that we can begin to sort out and figure out how we create the mechanisms to be able to at least theoretically make the decisions that could enable us to avoid this, recognizing, as Paul said, it's hard not to be utterly cynical, and it's hard not to feel kind of silly to even say, oh, we have to reduce fossil fuels, because people have been saying that probably billions of times over decades with little to show for it. So, as always, I want to thank Peter and Paul. We haven't resolved this problem today. We don't usually resolve problems because we're unable to, because these are problems that are so multidimensional and so challenging. But I hope that you will agree with us that we've shed some light today on one of the biggest unknowns and most catastrophic unknowns the world faces, which is the collapse of the circulation system in the North Atlantic and elsewhere on the planet. And now, to the aspect of our program we do every week, which is to highlight in less than 1 minute each three of the biggest climate stories of the past week. And the first one is, unfortunately, there is yet another marine heat wave that is brewing across the Pacific. It's a massive ocean hotspot stretching across, believe it or not, a 5,000-mile swath of the Pacific from Micronesia to California. Across this zone, waters are as much as 6 to 8 degrees above average. And it has the attention, naturally, of climate scientists who say that it will boost temperatures, humidity, and the threat for tropical storms in the West during the months ahead. Climate scientist David Swain described this as an exceptional event that's breaking records. And it's the largest ocean anomaly on the planet. In addition to its impact on our lives, these marine heat waves kill millions or tens of millions of sea creatures every time they occur. So it's something to keep an eye on. It's something to prepare for, particularly if you're in the western part, Canada or the United States. And I'm sure we'll probably have these almost every year coming ahead. That's number one. The second story is a major new report was just released a couple of days ago from the UN Food and Agricultural Organization and the World Meteorological Organization. And it finds, maybe not surprisingly, that food supplies are already being, quote, pushed to the brink by increasingly common heat waves. Speaking of marine heat waves, the livelihoods of more than 1 billion people are in peril, with farmers unable to work outside, livestock experiencing stress, and crop yields failing. This, of course, is a potential and probably actual disaster. The report warns that adaptation alone is not enough, and we need to take much more extreme measures, which, of course, is why we have the Climate Emergency Forum, because this is yet another example of the climate emergency. And lastly, the day that I am recording this is pretty much around the same time that a historic conference is underway in Santa Marta, Colombia, where somewhere around 50 to 60 countries will gather for a summit aimed at accelerating the shift away from fossil fuels. Co-hosted by Colombia and the Netherlands, the conference is bringing together ministers, governments, academics, and civil society groups to discuss how to move beyond oil and gas and coal while ensuring a just, orderly, and equitable transition. It's hard to believe that 30 years after the world has gotten together to deal with climate change, that this is apparently the first time such a conference has been organized. And the only reason, and this is me, not from the article that I'm reading from, it's necessary is because the annual COPs have not been able or have been unwilling to address the need to phase out of fossil fuels. They don't even talk about it, in part because there are well over 1,000 fossil fuel lobbyists that come to every one of the Conference of the Parties meetings. I think we all need to hope and pray, send our best wishes to the folks there in hopes that something more than just reports will come out of this. And given its importance, we plan on doing a special program devoted to what happened at this conference coming up very shortly, and we hope you will stay tuned for that. So with that, as the Climate Three, I want to thank you as always for joining us today. I hope you will like and subscribe to our program, leave us your comments, and as always, we look forward to seeing you next week. Thank you.